Have you ever wondered what happened to the legendary Chuck Norris? We recently saw a video he made and it was shocking. He's in his 80s and still kicking butt, working out, staying active, and even has plenty of energy left over for his grandkids. He did this by just making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife tried too, and she says she feels 10 years younger. Her body looks leaner and she has energy all day. With the stress of everyday life, on top of the toll all the world's terrible news takes on us, it's more important than ever to stay healthy. My Morning Kick is the way to do it. Chuck made a video that explains everything. Make sure you watch it by going to mymorningkick.com/useful. It'll change the way you think about your health. Once again, that's mymorningkick.com/useful. You won't believe how simple it is.
Hi, my name is Peter, and I'm a prophet in the new novel, American Prophet. I prophesied a natural disaster, a pandemic, and that crazy election. Now there are conspiracies about me. A dude is shooting at me, and the president is threatening me. My story is on Amazon, Audible, and Apple Books. Check it out. Just look for American Prophet by Jeff Fulmer. That's American Prophet by Jeff Fulmer.
For this week's guest, we are joined by one of the most influential political scientists in the world. John Mearsheimer is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago, has influenced political science scholarship around the world for a long time now, and is known for his heterodox views on many issues, including the Ukraine proxy war, and now also the Gaza conflict, where he wrote a seminal book about the influence of the Israel lobby on U.S. politics. He co-wrote that with Stephen Walt, which has new relevance today as we're seeing Israel-Palestine continue to dominate U.S. politics and, you know, cast a really major shadow over the upcoming election. So we're going to talk to John Mearsheimer about all that and more. So this is John Mearsheimer.
Welcome, and thank you so much for joining.
My pleasure to be here.
I wanted to start off by asking you a kind of maybe nerdy question, but you are, of course, of the realism school. And I've heard you a lot of your lectures, and you like to kind of frame the terms of debate or terms of discussion. So I want to know, for people who don't know what that means, what does that mean? And what other kinds of schools are there that other political scientists are from?
Well, in the political science world, and I think this is true in the United States and the West more generally, there are sort of two bodies of theory that inform how people think about the world. One are the realists, and the other group are the liberals. And I'm clearly a realist. And realists basically believe that great power politics is the dominating feature of international relations, and that the United States should not be involved in small wars all over the world. So it's no accident that almost all the realists focus on China's rise and care about China's rise, although there are differences of opinions among realists on how to deal with China. But given the realists' focus on great power politics, we tend to focus laser-like on the rise of China. And with regard to wars in places like Iraq, Vietnam, Afghanistan, we think it's disastrous for the United States to fight these wars. The liberals, on the other hand, because they essentially have a crusader mentality, are interested not only in great power politics, but they're interested in running around the world and trying to turn countries into liberal democracies at the end of a rifle barrel. So what you see in the United States, at least since the end of the Cold War, when great power politics disappeared because the Soviet Union disappeared, is that the United States decided that it was going to pursue this policy of liberal hegemony, where it went around the world trying to promote democracy, oftentimes at the end of a rifle barrel. It tried to integrate all sorts of countries into the liberal international order, and so forth and so on. And realists were just much more skeptical about using military power to promote democracy. In fact, most realists are not interested in promoting democracy in other countries. They tend to respect the sovereignty of other states. And as you both well know, the United States does not respect the sovereignty of other states. We think we have a God-given right to intervene in the politics of every country on the planet. And that basically comes from the liberal impulse that's sort of hardwired into the body politic. So I think in a nutshell, that's what separates the realists from the liberals. And as I said initially, I think the realists and the liberals are the two big schools of thought in the United States.
Let's talk about the Ukraine proxy war. As we're recording this, we're on the two-year anniversary of Russia's invasion. 1 year ago, the mood was very different in the West. There was a sort of feeling of triumphalism. Ukraine had recently captured, retaken two key provinces from Russia. They were gearing up for a counteroffensive encouraged by the U.S. This year, we've just had the Munich Security Conference, the annual gathering of the NATO foreign policy elite, and the mood was very different, where things are feeling bleak. Ukraine just lost a very key town of Avdiivka, dire reports from the front lines. Republicans in the House are stalling a new $61 billion request by President Biden to prolong the proxy war. What is your assessment of where things are at?
Well, I think that the Ukrainians are obviously in terrible shape. I think that, as you point out, the balance of power has shifted over the past year in quite significant ways. And I believe that moving forward, the balance of power between the Ukrainians on one side and Russians on the other side will shift further to the Russians' advantage. So Russia's position will improve militarily over time. And that just means that the Ukrainians, if they continue to fight this war, will lose even more territory. And all this talk in the West about, you know, rearming the Ukrainians having them go back on the offensive and take back the territory that they lost is simply delusional. As I say, the balance of power, if anything, is going to shift against Ukraine over time. And they are, in effect, doomed. And the only question at this point in time that I think is interesting is how much territory Ukraine ends up losing. If I were in the driver's seat in Kyiv, what I would do is try and reach some sort of agreement now and accept the fact that the Russians are going to keep the four oblasts that they've annexed and also keep the Crimea and do everything I can to prevent them from taking the next four oblasts that are to the west of the four oblasts they've already taken. That would include Kharkiv and Odessa. But I think what you want to do if you're a Ukrainian at this point in time is minimize the damage and accept the fact that you're just not going to get those four oblasts plus Crimea back. But this is not the way they're thinking, and it's certainly not the way people in the West are thinking. So what we're doing, and of course, this does not include the three of us, but what the country, the United States, is doing, the Biden administration is doing, is encouraging the Ukrainians to fight on. By feeding this line that they can eventually win, which, as I say, is misguided in the extreme.
You have Russians like Medvedev saying now that we need to take Kyiv. Do you think that is a reflection of Putin's goal, or is this possibly Medvedev in the role of bad cop to other Russians, good cop, who might be more amenable to a negotiated settlement that doesn't see Russia take over all of Ukraine, a goal that you've been very skeptical of from the start? You've argued that Russia never intended to absorb all of Ukraine, as many supporters of the proxy war in the West will claim.
Yeah, it's very important to emphasize that there is zero evidence that Putin has any interest in conquering any country outside of Ukraine. And I believe there is zero evidence that he has any interest in conquering all of Ukraine. And indeed, there's an abundance of evidence that he doesn't want to conquer the western part of Ukraine. Let's just call it the western half of Ukraine. And in fact, if you listen to him talk these days, he talks about Poland, Hungary, and Romania retaking the parts of Western Ukraine that used to belong to them. He raises this specter. And all of this just makes clear he's not taking that territory for Russia. And of course, he would be crazy to do that, because the further west you move into Ukraine, the more you run into territory that's occupied by ethnic Ukrainians, almost all ethnic Ukrainians who hate the Russians. And he surely understands that if he occupies that territory, he's going to have a major insurrection on his hands. And that's the last thing he needs. He's much better off just taking a wide swath of territory in the eastern part of Ukraine, where there are lots of ethnic Russians and lots of Russian speakers, and annexing that to Russia. And all of the evidence is that that is what he plans to do. Now, whether he takes Kyiv is hard to say for sure. I would actually be surprised if they took all of Kyiv. They might take the part that's on the eastern bank of the Dnieper, but I don't think they'll take all of it. The problem that you run into is conquering a large city like Kyiv is a major undertaking. The cost would be enormous for the Russians. And then you own a city that's going to be filled with people who don't like you owning their city and will resist. So I think that they'll leave Kyiv alone. It will remain the capital of a dysfunctional Ukrainian rump state. But nevertheless, they will take lots of other territory. I mean, if I were playing Russia's hand, I'd try to take all of Odessa. I'd try to take all of Kharkiv. I'd take a lot of territory. What you want to do if you're Russia is you want to weaken Ukraine as much as you can. And the reason that you want to do that is because once you get a cold peace, and you'll eventually get a cold peace, you're not going to get a meaningful peace agreement here because the Americans and the Ukrainians won't agree to a meaningful peace agreement. You're going to get a cold peace. And when you have a cold peace, the United States and the Ukrainians will go to great lengths over time to undermine Russia's position in the territories that it's annexed. They'll try to cause all the trouble they can for the Russians. And the Russians, of course, will try to cause all sorts of trouble for that rump state that becomes Ukraine, or that is Ukraine. And they'll try to cause all sorts of trouble in Europe. The Russians will. And I don't blame them one bit if I were playing their hand. But anyway, all of this is to say, if you're playing their hand, you have a vested interest in grabbing a lot of Ukrainian territory, as much as you can. And this is why I said a few minutes ago that from Ukraine's point of view, it makes sense to cut a deal now and prevent the Russians from taking more territory. And to prevent them from taking more territory, you have to eliminate the incentive for them wanting to do that. And the only way that you can eliminate that incentive is if you agree that you will not join NATO, that indeed there will be no strategic relationship, military relationship between the West and Ukraine, and Ukraine will be a genuine neutral state. If you can convince the Russians that you're willing to do that, and then you take the necessary steps to do that, I think you can minimize the amount of territory that they'll take. But if you don't do that, and I think we're not going to see the Ukrainians do that, the end result is that they have a powerful incentive to take as much territory as they can militarily, and to take as much territory as they can without ending up with lots of ethnic Ukrainians in their midst.
Let me put you a counterargument that I think someone from the Ukrainian government or a supporter in the West of the proxy war might make. They might say that, well, look, Russia's failure to take places like Odessa so far, and Russia's struggles in taking places like Avdiivka and Bakhmut, which Russia took, but at a considerable cost of people, shows that Russia is not as strong as everybody thought. And these experiences show that Russia can't take all of our countries, so let's just keep fighting on. What do you think of that argument? And do you think that argument understands what Russia's strategy has been so far?
Well, there's two points. First of all, what's the point of fighting on? If you believe the Russians can't take more territory, that you have a stalemate, and you can't launch an offensive to take back the territory you lost, there's no point in fighting on. Just cut a deal. It just makes common sense.
That was Mark Milley's position over a year ago, the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That was his stance, but unfortunately he was overruled.
Exactly. I mean, Milley understood that in the fall of 2022, remember the war starts February 24th, 2022. And by the fall of 2022, the Ukrainians have done quite well for themselves against the Russians. And Milley says, in effect, that this is the high water mark. We got to cut a deal. And the White House and the foreign policy establishment more generally say, oh, no, now's not the time to cut a deal. We have the Russians on the run, and let's finish them off. Let's win a big victory in Ukraine. But this is, of course, crazy, because what's happening inside of Russia at that point in time is that Putin is finally beginning to mobilize the economy and mobilize troops and take advantage of the fact that Russia has a great advantage in producing weaponry over Ukraine and the West. And furthermore, it has about a 5-to-1 advantage in manpower, which means it could put many more troops on the battlefield than the Ukrainians do. Milley surely understood this and surely understood that it was time to quit while you're ahead. But that was not the way we saw it, and we pushed on. And here we are today in the wake of the counteroffensive. What happened with the counteroffensive cannot be underestimated, because that demonstrated that the Ukrainians could not launch an offensive to take back the territory they've lost. There's no way they can do it. So the only interesting question now is whether or not the Ukrainians can hold on to what they have. And in your question, you were implying that they could. And I said, well, if they can hold on to the territory that they now have over the next 10 years, why not just cut a deal now? Because you would save a lot of lives. It's the smart thing to do. The problem, Aaron, is I don't think that the Ukrainians can hold on to that territory. If you look at what's going on the battlefield of Avdiivka, for example, what happened there, it's beginning to look like the Ukrainian army is unraveling. There are real problems. The final stages of the Battle of Avdiivka were really a total disaster for the Ukrainians. They had troops that had just quit their positions and were running away. Some estimates are that 1,000 Ukrainian troops were captured by the Russians, and the situation looks bleak. And again, I may be wrong on this. There's no question about that. Maybe the Russians don't have the capability to move much beyond Avdiivka, but I think they do. And if they do, you want to cut a deal now.
There's a certain irony in the fact that people like you are smeared as Putin puppets, right? Then other people, the people who smear you, are people who compare Putin to Hitler and claim to be defending and protecting Ukrainians, but they are also actually prolonging a war, which is not just bleeding Russia, which is their overt aim, but bleeding Ukrainians. So what is actually going on? What is their real motivation?
Well, there's two things that are going on. As I like to say, when I was a little boy, my mother always taught me, when you can't beat people with facts and logic, what you do is smear them. You saw this with regard to Tucker Carlson and the interview with Vladimir Putin. Very little attention was paid to analyzing the facts and analyzing what Putin had to say and how it played out in the context of this war. Instead, what people focused on was smearing both Carlson and Putin. And this is just the way things operate in the West. So I've gotten to the point where I'm sort of an armadillo. I just, you know, it doesn't bother me at all anymore, because it's just the way the game is played. It's sad, because it's not the way things are supposed to work in a liberal democracy, but that's where we are. But what's really going on here, in my opinion, is I think that the foreign policy establishment, the mainstream media, which has backed this war almost to a person, has a deep-seated interest in having Ukraine win. It will be a humiliating defeat. if the Ukrainians lose and Putin wins. The foreign policy establishment and the mainstream media are doubling down now and doing everything they can to prolong this war. And it's easy to do that because they're not doing the fighting and the dying. And actually, if you listen to some people in the establishment talk, they make that point. It's the Ukrainians who are doing the fighting and dying. And in the process, they're wearing down the Russians. But in my opinion, it's not so important that they wear down the Russians. What's important to the people in the foreign policy establishment and the media is that the Ukrainians help to rescue their reputation. Because again, otherwise, they're not only going to have a lot of egg on their face for being dead wrong, they're also going to have a lot of blood on their hands. Because when this one is finally over with and everybody steps back and looks at what's happened, they're going to say, this is a giant catastrophe. It is just hard to believe how bad the consequences are, how widespread and how negative the consequences are of this Ukraine war. And for people who argued that this could have been avoided if we had just given up on turning Ukraine into a Western bastion on Russia's border, right, we're going to look like we were right. And we don't have blood on our hands. We were not the ones who pushed the Ukrainians into this horrendous war. It's the foreign policy establishment and the mainstream media that pushed them and made the argument that they could win. Just to take another example that deals with this very point, look at what happened immediately after the war started. In March and early April, you had negotiations in Istanbul, and it looked like the war was going to be settled then. But what happened? Boris Johnson and the Americans came in and told Zelensky to walk, not to continue the negotiations, which looked like they were going to bear fruit. We told Zelensky, continue the fight instead of negotiating a settlement at this point in time. He, of course, did that. Then to go back to the point that Aaron raised about General Milley in the fall of 2022, when Milley wanted to shut the war down because he understood that things were only going to get worse, the foreign policy establishment and the mainstream media dissed that idea, and the war went on. So you see that the American foreign policy establishment, and this includes its allies in Europe, and it includes the mainstream media, is the principal driving force behind this war. It was not the Ukrainians who wanted to join NATO. We came up with the idea in April 2008. At that point in time, the Ukrainians were deeply committed to neutrality. And what we did was we pushed hard for many years to bring Ukraine into NATO. And when the Russians protested, we basically gave them the high sign. We told them we didn't care. We were going to shove it down their throats. And the end result is you have this disastrous war. So the foreign policy establishment and the mainstream media have a deep-seated interest in hoping that the Ukrainians can pull a rabbit out of a hat and can win this war and rescue their reputations.
But what motivates them in the first place to support this war? So I understand you're saying now it's to save face and they're hoping that, that Ukraine can turn it around. But why are they in the first place in support of this?
I think they thought they could win. Right. Just if you go back to March, April, after the war started, well, let's do this. Let's go to the period between December 17th, 2021. This is when the Russians sent the letter to President Biden and to Jens Stoltenberg, the head of NATO, proposing some sort of deal, proposing setting up some meetings to work out a deal so that you could avoid conflict. From that point, December 17th, 2021, up until when the war started a few months later on February 24th, 2022, the Russians went to great lengths to try and avoid a conflict. They did not want a war. And we refused to play the game. We refused to engage with them. We just told them to take a hike. And we were saying at the time, as I'm sure both of you remember, that there's going to be a war. There's going to be a war. We were running around with a bullhorn telling Zelensky and others, there's going to be a war. There's going to be a war. Well, you would expect if that was the case, at the same time, we would have been trying to do something to avoid a war. We did virtually nothing to avoid a war. Then the war breaks out. And as we were saying before, what's going on in March and early April is that the Russians and the Ukrainians are negotiating in Istanbul, and it looks like they're going to work out some sort of agreement. And by the way, they were also, the Russians and the Ukrainians, working with Naftali Bennett, who was the Israeli prime minister at the time. And things were proceeding on the Naftali Bennett track in the same way that they were proceeding on the Istanbul track, which is to say, quite well. And it looked like you were going to get an agreement. But what happened is that the Americans and the British came in and told Zelensky to walk. And as I said to you before, I think it's because we thought that we could beat the Russians. We thought the Russians were very weak and we could just slap them around and they would just have to swallow NATO expansion. And if they started a conflict, we would beat them. You want to remember that we make the decision in the mid-1990s to expand NATO, and the Russians scream bloody murder from the get-go. But we shove NATO expansion down their throat in 1999, which is the first big tranche. Then in 2004, we shove the second big tranche down their throat. And then in April 2008, we decide there's going to be a third tranche, which involves Georgia and Ukraine. And even after the war in Georgia breaks out, a few months after the April 2008 NATO decision, you would have thought that the Americans would back off with regard to Ukraine. Look what happened in Georgia. Maybe we ought to rethink this. But no, we doubled down and we just thought we could shove it down their throats. And this is what informed our thinking, in my opinion, before February 24th, 2022. And then we thought we were going to win after that. And again, it's not until recently that we began to realize that this was delusional. And in fact, the Russians are likely to win what I would call an ugly victory. But what are we doing again? We're doubling down. And it's easy to do that because we're not paying the blood price. It's the Ukrainians who are paying the blood price. And if I can just say one other thing about that while I'm on stream of consciousness mode here. You know, if you read the articles in the newspaper about the demographic situation in Ukraine, it's sometimes said that Ukraine is a country that is in a demographic death spiral. Just think about those words. Ukraine is in a demographic death spiral. The last thing that Ukraine needs at this point in time is to suffer hundreds and thousands of deaths, which it's already suffered, and then to suffer more and more moving forward. I mean, this may be too strong a word, but this is insanity. I just kind of don't understand what people are thinking, both from a human rights or a moral point of view, as well as from a strategic point of view. Our policy is bankrupt, both morally and strategically.
And it's just motivated by a desire for hegemony?
Well, it was initially motivated by a desire to spread liberal democracy eastward, to spread our institutions like the EU and NATO eastward, to get Eastern European countries hooked on capitalism. It was the basic liberal hegemony policy that dominated during the unipolar moment. But then when the Russians began to resist, it became a policy that was designed to badly weaken Russia and knock Russia out of the ranks of the great powers. And this is what we thought we could do. We thought we would really damage Russia. And instead of being in a multipolar world now where you have three great powers, Russia, China, and the United States, we would be in a bipolar world where Russia was no longer a great power and the only two great powers were China and the United States. So you have this very interesting situation, which is that the more Putin resisted, the more committed we became to wrecking Russia. And the truth is that Putin actually did not resist very much between 2000 and I would argue even the fall of 2022. This is after the war started. And if you listen to Putin now talk, he says that he made a mistake in trusting the West for too long. And I thought that was true when it was happening. I thought before the war broke out in February 2022, and after it broke out, he trusted the West too much. In my opinion, the United States is a ruthless great power. The Russians should never trust the Americans. No country on the planet should trust the Americans. I wouldn't trust any great power for that matter. This is the realist streak in me. But anyway, Putin did. And because Putin was not as hard-nosed as one might have expected, the Americans thought they could push him around. And the more he pushed back over time, the more committed we became to wrecking Russia. I think in the end, we have failed.
In a recent interview, Putin specifically called out Angela Merkel of Germany and François Hollande of France, both of whom have admitted that the Minsk Accords, which was the peace accord signed in February 2015 to end the war in the Donbas in eastern Ukraine, which began after the 2014 Maidan coup, they admitted that the Minsk Accords were just used to buy time to prepare Ukraine to fight Russia, not to actually end the war. And Putin is obviously very bitter about that. And, you know, on that point, there are so many admissions now from NATO officials, from Ukrainian officials, and from Western pundits that back up the argument you've just given us on the background to this war. So I want to play just a few clips just to illustrate. The first clip is Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General. And he recently admitted that Russia went to war in Ukraine because it wanted to stop NATO encroachment on its borders.
The background was that President Putin declared in the autumn of 2021, and he actually sent a draft treaty that he wanted NATO to sign to promise no more NATO enlargement. That was what he sent us. And that was a precondition for not invade Ukraine. Of course, we didn't sign that. The opposite happened. He wanted us to sign a promise never to enlarge NATO. He wanted us to remove our military infrastructure in all allies that have joined NATO since 1997, meaning half of NATO, all the Central and Eastern Europe. We should remove NATO from that part of our alliance, introducing some kind of E and B or second class membership. We rejected that. So he went to war to prevent NATO, more NATO close to his borders. He has got the exact opposite.
And then we have, you know, fast forwarding to these critical peace talks you've discussed that occurred in Turkey in March, April 2022, where they were so close to signing a deal, Russia and Ukraine, but Boris Johnson came over and told Zelensky that the West would not have his back if he signed those deals. This is a Ukrainian diplomat named Oleksandr Chali, sorry if I pronounce his name wrong, who took part in the talks. And he said that Putin did everything possible to find a peaceful settlement with Ukraine.
I was in that moment in the group of Ukrainian negotiators. We negotiate with Russian delegation practically 2 months, in March and April, the possible peaceful settlement agreement between Ukraine and Russia. And we, as you remember, concluded so-called Istanbul communique. And we were very close in the middle of April, in the end of April, to finalize our war with some peaceful settlement. For some reasons, it was postponed. But to my mind, Putin, this is my personal view, Putin in 1 week after started his aggression in 24 February last year, very quickly understood he did mistake and tried to do everything possible to conclude agreement with Ukraine. And Istanbul communique, it was his personal decision to accept the text of this communique, which totally far away from the initial proposal of Russia, ultimatum proposal of Russia, which they put before the Ukrainian delegation in Minsk. So we managed to find a very real compromise. So Putin really wanted to reach some peaceful settlement with Ukraine. It's very important to remember.
So much for a Hitlerian march.
I noticed how he says for some reason this deal was postponed. He doesn't detail why, which is that Boris Johnson came over and told Zelensky that the West wouldn't support it and that Ukraine should keep fighting Russia. And just one more clip. John, you mentioned how people in the West brag now that that Ukrainian lives are cheap, that we're basically, they're dying on our behalf. A person to recently lay that out is the editor of The Economist, a very influential magazine, Zanny Minton Beddoes, speaking to Jon Stewart.
To be clear, aiding Ukraine, giving the money to Ukraine, is the cheapest possible way for the U.S. to enhance its security. It's just, it's absolutely, the fighting is being done by the Ukrainians. They're the people who are being killed. The U.S. and Europe are supplying them weapons. And in doing so, we are pushing back against Putin. I mean, I've been to Kyiv twice, right, and lived there 30 years ago. And you can't go there and not think, this is a European country that is looking westward. And for the U.S. to abandon it now, if it does, it's almost jaw-dropping.
So, John, we just heard, you know, all these admissions from these voices from the West, these prominent voices, basically, you know, underscoring the points that you've made. But yet, for some reason, you know, admissions like this don't make a dent, it seems to me, in the narrative that Western media consumers are getting about this war.
Well, I do believe they make a dent. You know, if you look at public opinion polls in the United States and in Europe, there's a recent poll produced by the European Council on Foreign Relations that shows that only 10% of Europeans think that Ukraine can win the war. And the Quincy Institute has just released a poll that shows that only 12% of Americans think that Ukraine can win the war. What you have here is a real disjuncture between what the elites think and what the publics think. This is an elite-driven war. The elites are deeply committed to this war. But we have a whole plethora of alternative media platforms that all sorts of people watch. And I believe the word has gotten out to the public as to what's going on in Ukraine. The problem is that the elite media, right, keeps people like us, for the most part, out of the discussion. And therefore, the elite is, in a sense, talking to itself. And they just go back and forth, purveying the conventional wisdom. And it seems like the truth is not getting out. But the fact is that shows like your show and all sorts of other shows that are out there are getting the word out there. And it is having an effect in the public. But the problem, again, is the elites are so deeply committed to this war that they just can't turn around. They have to keep pushing forward. And this is what you see happening. So I think that you don't want to just simply say that the word is not getting out and people are not changing their minds. It's the elite that is the problem. But I just want to say a few words about those clips that you showed. First of all, the Stoltenberg clip is truly amazing. Stoltenberg is making the argument that people like us have made from the get-go, which is this is not a war about conquest. This is not a war where Putin is trying to create a greater Russia. He says very clearly that this is all about NATO expansion. It's a very articulate, from my point of view, it's a very articulate enunciation of my view on what caused the war. And it's coming from Jens Stoltenberg. Quite amazing. With regard to the ambassador, of course, he's exactly right. He's reporting what has now become the conventional wisdom among most people outside of the foreign policy establishment. And with regard to the editor of The Economist, I mean, she should really step back and think about the moral dimension of her comments. I mean, it's really kind of horrifying to think that somebody in that position is so cavalier in her treatment of Ukrainian lives.
And just a quick point before we move on to Gaza, the other major conflict in this world, the existence of these peace talks in March and April 2022, and the admission there from that Ukrainian official that they were so close to a peace deal, it doesn't get reported in Western media. And I just wonder how long it will take. Will it take until we get the internal documents from the U.S. confirming that they sabotaged these peace talks? Is that how long it will take for the Western media to just acknowledge that they happened? Because it's very difficult, at least in the U.S., to find any kind of acknowledgement that these talks took place and they were so close to a deal.
Yeah, I'm not very hopeful on that front. I think my views are kind of similar to yours. I don't see the media doing much of a turnaround. I mean, where the media has to do a turnaround is in terms of reporting what's going on the battlefield. And if you read the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times, you are now seeing, I'd say twice a week in each one of those newspapers, a story that reports the dire straits that the Ukrainian army is in up on the front lines. And you even are beginning to see stories about the political turmoil inside of Kyiv. They just can't deny that. But when you start talking about historical instances like what happened back in March/April 2022, I think they could still do a pretty good job of hiding that. The whole business about Minsk is another example. There's been very little discussion in the mainstream media of the fact that Angela Merkel, Francois Hollande, and Poroshenko, who was the Ukrainian president at the time, basically bamboozled Putin. And Putin, of course, was operating in good faith. He made the mistake of trusting those Western elites, and they took him to the cleaners. But you don't hear much about that. And in fact, when you talk to people in the establishment about that case, they will tell you that Merkel and Hollande really don't believe that. That's not really what happened. Mm-hmm. They're just making this up now. And in fact, the principal reason that Minsk didn't work was because of Putin. And this is exactly what you'd expect from the mainstream media or from the foreign policy establishment. Putin is responsible for all things that have gone wrong. We're the good guys. He's the bad guy. As Katie pointed out on a number of occasions, he's the equivalent of Adolf Hitler, and so forth and so on. So that's kind of where we are.
I would offer a third possibility that actually, yes, Merkel and Hollande did not mean what they say when they said that Minsk was a ruse. They actually tried to implement Minsk, but the people who stood in the way were actually Ukrainian ultra-nationalists who threatened Zelensky's life if he implemented Minsk and held violent protests against it, and their allies in Washington, D.C., that actually Merkel was sincere, but is now pretending that she was playing along with the charade of Minsk all along because now it's not fashionable to support diplomacy with Russia. That's my speculation.
I think you may be right. And by the way, we know that Merkel and Sarkozy, who was the French president in 2008, both Merkel and Sarkozy were opposed to NATO expansion into Ukraine at the famous Bucharest summit. And in fact, Merkel has subsequently said that the reason she was opposed was she understood, and this is really quite remarkable, that Putin would interpret that decision as a declaration of war against Russia. Really quite remarkable. But you couldn't stop the Americans. That was the problem.
So shifting gears to another war, or I mean, I don't know if you can even call it war. You can call it maybe a massacre. I know you've referred to it in the past as a massacre, and others are calling it genocide. What is motivating the United States' support for Israel's brutal assault on Gaza?
Well, my view on this is straightforward. I believe that 90% of it is accounted for by the lobby. I believe that all of these organizations and individuals who are profoundly committed to supporting Israel no matter what, basically wield so much influence in the United States that hardly any politician, certainly no president or no congressional leader, would dare to oppose Israel. So you have this anomalous situation where the United States is really the only country in the world or the only major power in the world that is willing to support Israel no matter what. And again, I think it's due to the lobby. It's not in our strategic interest, and it's certainly not in our moral interest. From a strategic point of view, it's quite clear that what Israel is doing is causing us enormous problems. And how could it possibly be in our moral interest to support a country that is committing genocide. And I do believe it is in the process of committing genocide. And if you don't believe it's committing genocide, it's at least committing mass murder. So whether it's mass murder or it's genocide, this is just absolutely something that the United States should not be supporting for moral reasons. And again, we should not be supporting from for strategic reasons. But why are we supporting Israel down the line? And the answer is the lobby.
And we do call it on the show a genocide. What about Biden's own seeming personal commitment to Zionism? You think that's a factor?
Yes. That's why I use the number 90%. I think some of this has to do with the fact that Biden has a powerful impulse to support Israel no matter what. I think one could say he wears blinders when it comes to Israel, independent of the lobby. But I think even with those blinders on, if there was no lobby, I believe that Biden would have acted differently over the past few months than he has acted. And he could have told himself a story that, you know, pushing forward a ceasefire, an immediate ceasefire, and preventing the Israelis from murdering huge numbers of Palestinians was in Israel's interest. I would make that argument. I think that what Israel is doing is not in its interest. If you went back to October 7th and you put me in the driver's seat in Israel, I was, you know, running Israeli foreign policy, I certainly would not have done what the Israelis have done. I think it's not in their interest. It's remarkably foolish from a strategic point of view, and it's morally bankrupt. The idea that the Jewish state is being accused of genocide is really kind of sickening to think about. But that's where we're at, and it's because they have pursued this policy. So I think if you're Joe Biden, you can tell yourself a story that I would have been helping Israel. It would have been in Israel's interest for me to get tough with them. And by the way, we know he's tried to get tough with them rhetorically. When he calls Bibi up on the phone, he gets tough on the phone. But getting tough on the phone doesn't mean anything. The question is, can you take concrete steps to try to rein him and the Israelis more generally in? And he's unwilling to do that. And I think he's unwilling to do that because he's up for re-election this fall. And he knows that if the lobby is unhappy with him and the lobby puts its gun sights on him, he's toast in the election.
What about from a self-interested strategic perspective, though? What about the risk he's playing with alienating his own supporters? In other words, do you think it's a rational decision that makes sense?
Well, I mean, I think what you're saying gets the fact that he is in a lose-lose situation. I think that it's quite clear that when you look at younger voters and you look at younger Democrats and you look at younger Jews in the United States, that he has a real problem. This is not good. And he surely understands this. And this is surely one of the reasons that he's trying to do everything he can to sort of get Netanyahu to back off and to get some sort of ceasefire. But at the same time, as I said, he understands that if he puts pressure on Israel, he plays hardball with the Israelis, he will pay an enormous political cost for doing so. So it's kind of your logic, Katie, plus my logic that tells you why he is in a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation.
What about getting on the phone the way Ronald Reagan did with the Begin during the assault on Lebanon when Reagan was president? Is that something that would not be possible now because of the lobby?
Yeah, I think the lobby has gotten much more powerful with time. I've spent a lot of time thinking about American thinking about Israel. You know, when I grew up as a boy, Israel was seen as, you know, the shining light on the hill. I often think of the book Exodus by Leon Uris, which informed how people like me thought about Israel at the time. They were the good guys and the Arabs where the Palestinians were clearly the bad guys. It all began to change in 1982. The invasion of Lebanon is very important in that regard. And then, of course, in the late 80s, you had the first Intifada. And that's when the new historians in Israel began to tell the story about how Israel was really created, which had a fundamental effect on how all sorts of people, me included, thought about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And of course, then you had the failure of the Oslo Accords, you had the Second Intifada, and so forth and so on, endless building of settlements. So what's happened since 1982 when the Israelis invaded Lebanon is that stellar reputation that Israel had in 1982 has inexorably disappeared. And in fact, the Israelis now are in real trouble in terms of their standing in the West more generally, and in the United States in particular. But you're talking about Reagan and Begin back in 1982. And the lobby was not that powerful then because it didn't have to be. Reagan had more maneuver room. That's not to say the lobby wasn't powerful in 82 or throughout the 1980s, because the lobby was powerful. But it was not as powerful then as it is now. See, what's happened is the lobby has a much tougher job now. It did not have a tough job when you were dealing with the young John Mearsheimer, because I was remarkably naive, and to put it in slightly different terms, I was remarkably ignorant. But I've learned a lot more about what really happened and has been happening over time. So to deal with the likes of the elder John Mearsheimer, the lobby has to work much harder, if you understand what I'm saying. And it does work hard, and it's very successful. I mean, the lobby is a truly impressive set of institutions and individuals. I wish that were not the case. As I've said on countless occasions, it would be better for the United States and it would be better for Israel if the lobby wasn't so powerful. But the lobby is powerful, and they go to enormous lengths to shut down discourse in the United States that's critical of Israel. And they go to enormous lengths to influence how policymakers act when it comes to Israel. And again, they are wildly effective, and they have to be, because there are just a lot of doubters in the body politic at this point in time.
You wrote the definitive book on the Israel lobby in 2007, along with your colleague Stephen Walt. But I'm wondering, I mean, are you surprised at all by the level of support that the Biden administration has given Israel throughout the course of its mass murder campaign, rushing weapons, bypassing Congress, endorsing the allegation against UNRWA lodged by Israel that a handful of staffers were involved in the October 7th attack? We've just gotten a report from the Wall Street Journal saying that U.S. intelligence has actually given this an assessment of low confidence, meaning they have no evidence for it. You know, acting as helpless bystanders, even as Israel blocks the delivery of flour and other basic goods into Gaza. I know you've documented the extensive influence of the lobby and the cynicism of Israeli policy, but I'm wondering if Biden's conduct has surprised you at all.
It's a very interesting question, and I don't have a simple answer, but I do have an answer. At first blanch, I'm shocked. I mean, it's so outrageous that how can I not be shocked? But then I take 2 minutes to think about it and I say, why am I surprised? Steve and I wrote this book, and we both argue that the lobby has gotten more powerful with time. So we shouldn't be shocked. This is just business as usual. And then I'm no longer shocked. But initially, I am shocked because, again, it's outrageous. I actually find it hard to believe that the Israelis are doing this. I almost can't believe it. It's so horrible. It's so outrageous. But then when you think about Israeli behavior over time, right, which I know a lot about, and you think about the lobby and how American presidents react to things that Israel does, it's really not that surprising.
Did you have an aha moment when your view of Israel changed? Was there a particular thing you learned about Israel through the new historians, or a particular thing that the Israeli government did in real time that changed the way you saw them?
I think the new historians mattered enormously. I think Avi Shlaim, Benny Morris, and those books really fundamentally altered how I thought about the creation of Israel and how I thought about how the Israelis treated the Palestinians. So I think there's no question that the new historians, for me anyway, really mattered a lot. I would also note, this is a different conversation, that my views on Israel and how to think about Israel have evolved over time. It wasn't something that happened overnight. And I remember after Steve and I wrote the book, and we went on a book tour in the Middle East, and we actually went to Israel, which was lots of fun because the Israelis, you could talk about the lobby in Israel in ways you can't in the United States.
Ironically.
And the Israelis admitted there was a lobby. I mean, there was no denying there was a lobby. They were glad there was a lobby. And the Israelis wanted to fight with us about it. And Steve and I like a good intellectual fight. So it was actually very enjoyable. But I remember when Steve and I were flying back, we were both flying back to London, and he was going to go on to Boston. I was going to go on to Chicago. And I think I said this to him. I don't think he said it to me, but he, of course, agreed. I said, you know what's going on here? I said, we're basically treating Israel as a normal country. We're basically treating Jews as normal people. And we're basically treating the lobby as a normal interest group in the United States. And if you think about it, there are two groups of people who don't think that Jews are normal people. One are Jews themselves, who think they are the chosen people. And the other are anti-Semites who think Jews are the devil incarnate. But you and I are two people who just think they're normal people. Jews are Jews. That's just the religion, right? And with regard to Israel, Israel misbehaves, but lots of countries misbehave. And we all know that's true. It's not like Israel's the only country on the planet that has done bad things, right? And we're just calling them out. And we've called other countries out, including our own country. So what was going on here is that we were treating Israel as a normal country, and we're treating Jews as normal people. But for people in the lobby, that is not the way they think about the world. They think Jews are different, and they think that Israel is different, and that anybody who criticizes Israel is criticizing Jews is an anti-Semite. And I think that's fundamentally wrong. But all I'm saying to you is it took me a long time to realize this, that we were just treating Israel as a normal country, and that's what was getting us in trouble.
Well, it's ironic because, as you pointed out, that the two groups that see Jews as exceptional are some Jews, I would say, the Jews who think that we're the chosen people, and anti-Semites. Another place that they have the agreement on is conflating Zionism with being Jewish, right? Because anti-Semites will use the term Zionist and Jew interchangeably. And then the lobby suggests that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. So they're both perpetuating the dual loyalty trope.
Absolutely. Just quickly on this, another thing while we're talking about the experience that Steve and I had writing the book, first writing an article, actually, that appeared in the London Review of Books. And then
after the Atlantic refused to publish it, right?
Yes.
They commissioned it and then refused to publish it.
Yes. I could tell you stories all day about that. But anyway, just on the business of talking about Jews, right? One thing we learned, and it's emblazoned in my brain, is you never want to talk about the Jews. Right. In fact, you never want to talk about the anythings, right? Because there's wide variation in the American Jewish community on the subject of Israel. There are lots of American Jews who don't give a hoot about Israel. There are lots of American Jews who are deeply committed Zionists who hate people like Steve and I. But as I have often pointed out, almost all of our defenders when we were being attacked were Jewish. It's very important to understand that. Very few of the goyim came to our defense. They were all down in the foxhole keeping their heads
low. Right, because they don't want to be called anti-Semites.
Yes, that's right. But there were a large number of Jews, you know, who agreed with us and came to our defense. And the most prominent was Tony Judt, who wrote this wonderful op-ed in the New York Times. And by the way, there were other Jews like Norman Finkelstein and Noam Chomsky who disagreed with us. They disagreed with the substance of our argument, but they supported us in that they said that we had the right to make the argument and we should not be attacked. So what we discovered at the time is there was just this huge variation inside the American Jewish community. And therefore, you never wanted to say the Jews this or the Jews that.
Can you walk us through what would happen if Biden were to actually exert pressure on Israel? What do you think the lobby would do?
Well, the lobby would go to work immediately in Congress and do certain things so that even if Biden took certain policy steps, Congress could move in and override, so to speak, any decisions that Biden made. They'd go to great lengths to put pressure on Biden's advisors, people like Blinken and Sullivan, and countless other people who work directly for the president. They would go to great lengths to make it clear that, you know, campaign contributions would dry up, or some campaign contributions would dry up, and that they would go to great lengths to tell people not to vote for Biden because he's an anti-Semite. That, of course, that would be the argument. He's anti-Israel, therefore he's an anti-Semite. See, it's a lot trickier for Arab Americans than it is for the lobby, because Arab Americans, if they don't vote for Biden, it's in effect a vote for Trump. And one could argue that Trump is as bad, if not worse, for Arab Americans than Biden is. But for American Jews who want to make the argument that you shouldn't vote for Biden, and you say, well, that's a vote for Trump, for most of those people, that doesn't matter because Trump is probably more supportive, or at least as supportive, of what Israel wants to do than Biden. Going to Trump is not a lot of, is not a big problem for the lobby as it would be for Arab Americans.
What a depressing state of affairs.
Unequivocally depressing. Yeah.
And what do you predict is going to happen? Are they going to clear the strip? What happens then?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think there's sort of two big questions. One is, are they going to clear the strip? Are they going to cleanse the strip? And then the second question, which is related to that, is what does the settlement look like? What happens after the shooting stops in the strip? My guess is they're not going to cleanse the strip. And you want to take what I say with many grains of salt, because I don't want them to cleanse the strip. So I think in a way I want to believe that they're not going to cleanse the strip. I believe that they want to still cleanse the strip. And when I see the Egyptians building infrastructure to house Palestinians driven out of Gaza, that makes me very nervous. And, you know, the Rafah is right next to the Egyptian border. So they could drive a substantial number of people out. And of course, the Biden administration wouldn't do anything. But I don't think they're going to get away with it. I don't think they're going to do it. So I think you're going to end up with a huge number of Palestinians still in Gaza. And that brings us to the second question. What does it look like? I think this is going to be a festering wound for the foreseeable future. I think the Israelis made a huge mistake. I alluded to this before when I talked about what I would have done if I had been in charge. They made a huge mistake going into Gaza because they're not going to get out of Gaza. They're not going to decisively defeat Hamas. Hamas is going to effectively rearm and come back at them. There are limits to how many troops the Israelis can keep in Gaza, in good part because it has negative economic consequences. One of the principal reasons they've drawn down, the Israelis have drawn down so many troops in Gaza since January of this year is that it was having terribly negative effects on the economy, because many of the reservists who were serving in the IDF work in the tech industries that are so essential for making the Israeli economy flourish. But there are limits to how many troops they can keep in there. They're dealing with a formidable adversary. And then world opinion is going to kick in. People want to settle this one. They're tired of this conflict going on, and that includes the United States. And all people want to talk about these days is the two-state solution. And they're going to push the Israelis to accept a Palestinian state, to move towards a two-state solution. The Israelis, of course, are going to resist. The Israelis have no interest in a two-state solution. So you're going to have this huge political battle that's taking place, while at the same time, the Israelis are once again the occupiers in Gaza. Remember, Ariel Sharon, who was a hardliner of the First Order, pulled Israeli troops and settlers out of Gaza because he understood that the costs of occupying Gaza far outweighed the benefits. Well, the Israelis are back in. And if they can't ethnically cleanse, that same basic logic that costs outweigh benefits, I think, will kick in. And I think it'll be worse this time because it's become a front burner issue on the international stage. This gets back to the point that I was making to you before about how the lobby's task has grown more difficult with time. If you go back into the 1980s, 1990s, and for at least the first 25 years of this century, right, the Israelis could get away with what they were doing with the Palestinians quite nicely. I mean, yes, they had a first intifada and a second intifada, but they were, you know, they were managing the problem. But after 2007, it doesn't look like they can manage the problem the way they once did. It's blown up in their face. And they're now back in Gaza, and you have this internationalization of the problem that you didn't have before. And I think it's going to cause huge problems for Israel. And I think it's going to hurt U.S.-Israeli relations. And it's going to cause more problems among young people for Israel and for, you know, the democratic establishment.
Can you talk about your experience in the military and how that perhaps influenced your worldview?
Well, you know, when you get to be older like me, you spend a lot of time thinking about how you ended up where you are. And when I was young, I never imagined that I would become a professor. I never even imagined I would get a PhD. And the idea that I became a prominent IR theorist was a thought that would have never crossed my mind. And if you told most people who knew me when I was young that John was going to grow up to be a prominent IR theorist, they would have said, "You're smoking bad stuff. This is just not in the realm of possibility." But it happened. And so I think about just sort of how this all happened. I think that being in the military during the Vietnam War, and I was in the American military from 1965 to 1975, which was coterminous with the Vietnam War, taught me in very important ways about the limits of military force. I think lots of people who haven't served in the military, and this includes lots of people in the foreign policy establishment and the mainstream media, believe that you could do magical things with a powerful military. You know, there's this very famous conversation that Madeleine Albright had with Colin Powell, where she said, "We have this remarkably powerful military, and we're not using it. And if we have it, we should use it." And Powell was very skeptical. And I believe that that's because Powell understood the limits of military force. I think that militaries, especially a military like the United States, is good at breaking things. It's good at smashing things. If you put it in a war with the Iraqi army in the desert in January, February 1991, you're going to win a splendid victory. But if you think that this army or this military can invade countries and do social engineering, you're living in a dream world. There are just real limits to what you can do with military force. And just go back to Gaza, right? There's no question in my mind that the IDF is far more powerful than Hamas is when you look at the raw balance of power. But you have to look at the context in which these two sides are fighting. And in that context, Hamas has all sorts of advantages over the Israelis that are not reflected in the raw balance of power. So my point here is that I think if you serve in the military and you get a good sense of what a blunt instrument it is and how inefficient it can be, and you get a real sense of how complicated war can be. This is what Clausewitz talked about, you know, the fog of war, the importance of friction, the importance of chance, right? You become very skeptical about using military force unless you absolutely have to. And by the way, most of my realist friends are more skeptical about containing China than I am, because they think even when it comes to great power politics, you know, you don't want to overreact. You don't want to place too much emphasis on containing China and so forth and so on. But anyway, all of this is to say, I do think that my military experience did teach me a lot about the limits of military force. And furthermore, I learned a lot about war and the nitty-gritty of war. And I think that, you know, if it comes to analyzing Ukraine's prospects of launching a successful counteroffensive against Russia in the summer of 2024, I am very well equipped to analyze the likelihood of Ukrainian success. I know a lot about the nitty-gritty of war and what you have to do to win a conventional war. And I learned a great deal of that when I went to West Point. I also think, just while I'm philosophizing here, the other thing that I learned at West Point was to be a truth teller. West Point placed a very high premium on telling the truth. And the idea was that you were training young combat officers. And if you send people into combat and somebody asks you, what does the situation look like to you in this particular area of the battlefield, it was terribly important that you be completely honest, because people's lives were involved and integrity, honesty was of enormous importance. And one of the sort of phrases that was used at West Point back in the day was, it's better to tell the painful truth rather than the easier untruth. And you just sort of learn that, you know, you tell it like it is. And if people don't like it, that's unfortunate, but your job is to be a truth teller. And I sort of took that away from my experience there. And I think it's informed my thinking, you know, over time. I've been willing to say controversial things that people don't like, because I think it's just important to tell what you think is the truth. This is not to say I have the truth and anybody who disagrees with me is wrong, because God knows I've been wrong on more than a few occasions in my lifetime, much to my regret. So I'm not always right, but I try to tell what I think is the truth. I try to be straight with people, whether they like it or not. And I'm not doing it to be mean-spirited, but I think that in the business that we're in, it is very important to be as honest as possible, to be as straight as possible with the facts and with logic. So I think all those things influenced me as a result of my time at West Point and in the military more generally.
And we're going to wrap it, just to go back to what we were talking about before with Mark Milley, another person who served in the military as the top military officer of the U.S. Can you think of another moment in history where the nation's top military officer is calling for diplomacy, and yet it doesn't make a difference to policy because all of his White House colleagues are basically pushing for more war?
No, I'd have to think about that. But off the top of my head, I can't think of another example. You know, there's a lot of evidence that in recent years, all sorts of military officers have emphasized the importance of the United States placing more reliance on diplomacy and less reliance on the military instrument. I think many people who are in the military would identify with the argument that I was making to Katie a minute ago about the limits of military force. I think most people who have been in the military understand their limits to what you can do with military force. The idea that, you know, people in the Navy and the Air Force are going to think that you can take American military power and just beat the Houthis down. I'd be willing to bet that most people, you know, who were involved in the decision-making process involving the Houthis, most people in uniform understood that there were significant limits on what you could do with American military force. So, you know, it's not that surprising that Milley was saying what he was saying. I've often said, Aaron, that I'll be anxious to see, I probably won't be around when this happens, but I would be anxious to see what kind of intelligence Milley is being fed. I have to believe that people in the CIA, people in the Defense Intelligence Agency, who were looking at the battlefield and what the balance of forces looked like, what the attrition levels looked like on both sides, had to see that the Ukrainians were at the high water mark and that things were likely to deteriorate. I could tell you all sorts of stories why I think they should have thought that based on the way the battle was playing out or the battles were playing out at the time. So I wouldn't be surprised if Milley was getting good intelligence that led him to that conclusion. It wasn't just an intuition on his part.
Plus possibly some intelligence about diplomatic overtures from Russia. There was recently a report in the New York Times that right around that time, in the fall of 2022, when Milley came out for diplomacy, that Putin sent out feelers through intermediaries to the U.S. talking about diplomacy. So maybe Milley was picking up on that as well.
Yeah, let me just say something about that. As we have said at numerous points in the discussion today, after the war starts in February, you have peace negotiations in Istanbul, and then there's the Israeli track as well. And that's in March and in early April, okay? But by mid-April, it's clear that that track has broken down. Zelensky has walked away, and the Ukrainians and the West are going to fight this one out. The question that then pops into my brain is, what do the Russians do? If I'm the Russians, what I do is I mobilize immediately, right? But Putin doesn't mobilize immediately. He doesn't mobilize those 300,000 troops until September of 2022. Indeed, the reason that the Russians lost all that territory in Kherson and lost all of Kharkiv is because they were overextended. They did not have enough troops to defend all of the territory they had conquered in February, March 2022. Just think about that. So here you have this window, let's call it from mid-April to mid-September, where Putin doesn't mobilize. And I'm saying to myself, why is that the case? It's consistent with the point that you're making, that Putin might have thought that he could still get a deal. And that's why he was putting out feelers. And it may be that Milley understood that not only was this the high watermark, but there was a possibility of getting a deal now because of what Putin is doing. Now, this is to some extent just speculation on our part because we don't have any of the details, but it is certainly a plausible story. And some of the pieces of that story are fact, the fact that Milley was trying to push for negotiation in the fall.
I've heard you speak about Julian Assange, so I wanted to know if you could very briefly explain why you think he shouldn't be extradited and why he should be freed.
Yeah, well, I think that Assange is a journalist, and I think journalists publish classified material all the time. I mean, what we have here in the United States is a situation where insiders leak important information for one reason or another, and this includes high-level government officials who are leaking information for strategic purposes, and of course, it includes insiders who are dissatisfied or angry about a particular policy who leak to journalists for that reason. And of course, the classic case here is Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. What happened here is that Chelsea Manning leaked the whole series of documents to Julian Assange, and Julian Assange published them on WikiLeaks. I believe that there is nothing wrong with a journalist, whether it's the New York Times and the Pentagon Papers case or Julian Assange in this case, or countless other examples of journalists publishing classified information. I think there's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, I think it's healthy in a liberal democracy like the United States, because you want to remember the state has a vested interest in keeping information from the public. And we in the public have a vested interest in getting our hands on that information, especially when the state is pursuing bankrupt policies or a reckless policy. And if you look at the Assange case, he was publishing information that made it very clear that we were doing lots of reckless things. And it was important that that information be out in the public domain. So again, I think he did a public service. And he also, again, in my opinion, was not doing something illegal. Chelsea Manning and Daniel Ellsberg did something that was illegal. They were part of the machine. And when you're part of the machine, you sign papers that say you won't leak classified information. And if you leak classified information, you can make the case that it's morally the right thing to do. I think this was Dan Ellsberg's view, but you can't argue, at least in my opinion, that it was the legally correct decision. And Ellsberg almost got prosecuted. I was actually shocked at the time that he didn't get prosecuted. I thought that he would, but he wasn't, which was, in my opinion, all for the good. But Chelsea Manning was prosecuted, spent some time behind bars, and has now been released. And I think that Julian Assange should not be prosecuted, should not spend any time behind bars. And I think if he does, it will have a chilling effect on journalism at a time where that is the last thing we need. Okay? We need more people to speak out. We don't need fewer people to speak out. The mainstream media and the foreign policy establishment are bad enough at this point in time in shutting down contrary opinions and not exposing malfeasance. I mean, we don't want to reinforce that. What we want to do is open things up even more. Be good for the United States, in my opinion. So I hope very much that British High Court does not extradite him to the United States.
John Mearsheimer, thank you so much for joining us.
You're more than welcome, Aaron. You're more than welcome, Katie. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Great. That was a great discussion.
That was a comprehensive interview. We covered a lot of topics.
A lot of ground.
John has done such important work, has been repeatedly vindicated. I mean, wrote very early on when it wasn't easy to about the role of the Israel lobby. And I have to admit, I was very sympathetic to the Chomsky view back then, that the influence of the lobby was being exaggerated. But I can't argue with Mearsheimer and Walt anymore on that. And also on Ukraine, he was the one who said in 2014, the Ukraine crisis is the West's fault. And he also said that the West was leading Ukraine on the primrose path and that Ukraine was going to get wrecked. And he proved to be exactly right. So how grateful are we to be able to get John Mearsheimer's insight on all these topics, Ukraine and Gaza at this awful time for the world.
Yeah. And some interesting insights into his personal journey.
Yes. And, you know, he said something that I thought was really notable. He talked about how you should never say the anyone, especially, you know, the Jews. And that reminded me of Dave Chappelle's joke from SNL where he said, you know, if I know one thing in show, but I'm paraphrasing. If I know one thing in working in show business, you never say these two words together, the Jews. And we can't play the clip because of copyright issues, but I don't know. Mearsheimer, Chappelle, two great minds.
Yeah, there you go. Also, Mearsheimer on his website, he has a little quiz, like what do Michael Jordan and Al Capone and John Mearsheimer have in common? They all started out in Brooklyn and made their names in Chicago.
There we go. Wow. Fair enough. And for more from John Mearsheimer, go to his Substack, which is at mearsheimer.substack.com. He regularly posts his articles and talks there. And our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. go there to support the show, get bonus content, including the extended version of this interview.
And Thursday Throwdown.
And of course, Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness, where we play all the funny clips that happen after Monday morning. So we just keep the Monday morning party going.
Yeah, you're going to want to see this week some really great Russia Gate mishigas.
It's back. Russia Gate's back, everybody.
Yeah.
It never left, but it's back.
Right.
All right, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time. Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.